Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Elections have consequences. Well, at least they should. The incoming Trump administration looks a lot like the outgoing Biden administration when it comes to Ukraine. Also, what do Romania, Georgia, and Moldova have in common? The answer is they are on the regime change menu. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we cross to Tariq Cyril Mar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with George in Budapest. You know, George, is the closer we get to Inauguration Day, and the more we hear from the Trump transition team, it sounds more and more like continuity of Biden's foreign policy. I mean, particularly when it comes to Ukraine. As a matter of fact, I've kind of coined it, it's the Ukrainian exception maybe, because it's just a maybe. So there's an enormous amount of continuity, and we'll talk about some of the cast of characters that he surrounded himself with. I have to say, like I said in the beginning of the program, elections have consequences, but it doesn't seem like it. These consequential elections are reflected in personnel policy. But anyway, go ahead, George.
No, I agree with you, Peter. And when one considers all of the recent pronouncements of President-elect Trump, it's very much a case of, as you say, continuity with the Biden administration, and maybe even a little bit more. All of the NATO leaders who have spoken to Trump in recent weeks since his election victory have all said, oh, I'm very confident that Trump will continue with this policy. Chancellor Scholz just a few days ago spoke to him and said, yeah, I think he's going to continue with this policy. And then the recent article in the Financial Times says that what Trump intends to maintain the same levels of, you know, or at least maintain the levels of aid to Ukraine as the Biden administration. And then on top of that, he wants the NATO member states to increase their defense spending to 5% of GDP. Now, all of that would suggest that Trump, and I think we've always known about this, is that he is very much within the Washington consensus. Sure, when he's running for office, he knows his base. He knows that within the Republican Party, there is indeed a very strong non-interventionist, let's focus on America wing, and he plays to that. But once he is there, once he's won the nomination, once he's in office, he kind of abandons all that. And although he has these things like, well, I think we're going to withdraw from the World Health Organization, you know, maybe withdraw from the United Nations. And, you know, this is stuff that goes well because the Washington consensus, you know, it hates any kind of restrictions on U.S. policy. But fundamentally, he maintains the status quo in Washington. He did that during his first term. And there's no indication that he intends to break it now.
Yeah, Tariq, it's kind of interesting because what we attach to Donald Trump since we've known him almost a decade now in public politics, it's amazing when you think about it. He didn't start any new wars. And that's true. But he seems to be challenged on ending a war. And I think that this is something that he's going to fall short of. The biggest problem here is that it seems like it's a one-way conversation. We keep hearing about ceasefires and delayed NATO membership, but nobody's consulted the Russians with this. Biden hasn't talked to Putin. Blinken hasn't talked to Lavrov beyond prisoner exchanges over the last few years. I mean, Russia isn't in the loop. How can you end a conflict if one party in the conflict isn't in the loop? Go ahead, in Istanbul.
Well, I would have two thoughts on this issue, right? One is, look, this is, I think, the 20th or 21st of December, right? 22nd already. Oh, my God. So close to Christmas. So, look, we have not even a month until inauguration, right? This is the 20th of January. And I see your point, Peter and George, absolutely. And you may very well be right in the end. But I do think that we don't know yet, and we will know sometime in the spring. We can only begin to really know after Trump's inauguration. There are reasons why this is not yet really something we can fully assess. Now, to the individual points you've raised, look, people like Scholz and Rutte or whatever, you know, they have an inbuilt bias. They have an interest to tell their audiences that everything is fine, it's cool, nothing bad is really happening. And so does Zelensky, by the way, right? So that evidence doesn't take us that far. I take your point that what we haven't yet gotten from Trump is clear signals that he's really going to do it, what he promised. Namely, let's not talk about 24 hours, it's a semi, but namely make peace quickly, and in essence, we all understand, by increasing pressure finally on Kiev and taking this sort of veto power away from Kiev. The whole Western world has to be at war with Russia indirectly, and only Kiev alone can decide when that stops. That's an insane situation that we've been living with for many years, right? Now, I personally am still more optimistic than the two of you seem to be. I admit that. I think it's possible that we still see major movement on ending the war. Now, there's one second point that I would like to raise, and then I'll stop, which is if you are right, which is possible, and Trump will, you know, turn this all around, turn it into a tool to blackmail the other NATO members into paying more, and then continue U.S. military or financial support for Ukraine or both, then, of course, Trump is in for a very bad surprise, because then Russia will keep fighting. And the outcome will be even worse for Ukraine and the West in the end.
Well, I mean, George, again, you know, ending the war. We're all fanatics about words on this program. Ending the war. How would that be different than Russia has to surrender? I mean, I think this is the same mindset. Yeah, the war will come to an end when Russia surrenders. I think that's what how that's their worldview. I can't see how, given the people that it has surrounded Trump, given his first administration, I can't conceive that they can think of it differently, George.
I don't think so, because, and this goes back to what I was saying about the Washington.
Are you agreeing or disagreeing with me?
No, I agree completely with okay. Your assessment that given that the Washington, and this is pretty much bipartisan, but for a few kind of MAGA America firsters among the House Republican conference, the Washington consensus is Russia are the bad guys. Russia needs to be stopped. Putin is another Hitler, and anything that can seem to be a victory for Hitler, which means victory for Putin, is a total disaster, and it has to be avoided. And I think Trump knows this. He knows his constraints, and you know, and we saw indeed last week. When he was just dealing with his own Republican caucus on a budgetary matter, despite the fact that he has just won this massive election victory, they just openly defied him. They just refused to do what he wanted them to do. And you can see the same thing is going to happen in foreign policy. And there, it's even stronger. The opposition to him is even stronger. So if he were to do, and you have to be brave in this. I mean, for him, because ultimately, I think, as Tariq said, the only way this comes to an end is if you tell Zelensky, you know, the jig is up, there's no more money, we're not going to do this. You have to sit down at the table and work something out with Putin on the basis of what's going on the lines right now, not on some, you know, theoretical thing. Now, Trump isn't really thinking along those lines, and instead he's made clear that he intends to maintain that Washington consensus. And when you look at the people that he has picked, it's hard to discern anyone there who would be the opposite, who would say to him, look, you know, it's time to bring this to an end. On the contrary, these are all people who are on the same page as the Biden administration. Yeah, this is very good. I mean, even on that thing with the releasing the any restraints on the use of the ATACMS. You know, his own people have said, yeah, we agree with this policy. He himself said, no, I don't. But the people around him have said, yeah, buddy, good idea.
You know, Teddy, again, words matter. I mean, to end a conflict is one thing, but to achieve peace is another. And that's another disconnect that we come from the discourse, not only from the transition team, but from the what is famously called the foreign policy blob. Words do matter. Go ahead, Tariq.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I totally agree. The achieving peace in the full sense of the word, that this is over, nobody's going to start again. The Ukrainians as well will accept the results for the future unlimitedly. And then one can actually rebuild normal economic relations and so on between all parties concerned. That, I think, is extremely difficult. I totally agree. Now, however, it is true, I believe, that it is possible, and this has happened before, after all, in history, that you can stop fighting without getting to that sort of peace. There is a place that looks like that, right? So to return to that question, could they actually manage to stop fighting? I don't quite agree that there are no people around Trump who dissent from the Biden consensus, which I think George have laid out very, very well in its all its fanaticism and simple-mindedness. You're absolutely right there. But look, Tulsi Gabbard, Director of Intelligence, J.D. Vance, yes, I know the vice president is just the vice president, but even if you look like Keith Kellogg, the designated Ukraine envoy, Kellogg is a very complicated, I think, ambiguous and ambivalent figure at this point, right? And that comes, we've talked about this before, it goes back to the paper he published together with Fleets of Late, where they were talking about what one could do, and which was this weird combination of, oh, we really want to talk to Russia and take them seriously, but we also want to twist their arms even more, right? And with Kellogg, you can never quite tell. He has condemned, and I think this condemned is too much, but he has spoken against the assassination of Kirillov, which he didn't have to do. And I think that he has, on the other hand, repeated stupid assessments of Russia's losses, where you don't know, does he actually believe that, or is he trying to make propaganda points? We don't know yet. But I do think that if your argument is that these people think exactly the way that the worst Bidenistas think, right? I get where you're coming from, but I don't quite agree. I think they are a bit different. But I agree with you.
Yeah, but I mean,
if you're saying we can't rely on it.
Again, maybe it's splicing words here. I mean, the rhetoric can be slightly different. I agree with you on that. But the outcome and the policy is not significantly different at the end of the day. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a break. And after that break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we're discussing some real news, and I'm going to go to Tariq on this one. I've come up with a phrase, a regime change menu. And currently on the menu, this season's menu, we have Romania, Moldova, and Georgia. Without, you know, tipping my hand here, do you like that phrase, regime change menu? Go ahead.
Yes, unfortunately, I think it's a very apt phrase because, that's what happens in the West, what happens between mostly Washington, they really call the shots on this, as on everything, and, you know, Washington's clients or vassals, they have these seasons where certain states are sort of slotted for having the regime change happen. And sometimes you get a surprise, which is, it's like Syria, you know, which was a horrible surprise in many ways, I think, where they conducted regime change suddenly and unfortunately it succeeded. Now, I believe if you ask me about this particular menu, Moldova, Ukraine, Georgia, I think you mentioned, right? Ukraine, of course, is a special case because they have to sort of solidify the regime change they've already done, right? Yes. So if you look at the two cases where they still want to have a regime change, or again, Moldova to solidify it, Romania, of course, Romania, Georgia, Moldova, I think Georgia, they're already losing, frankly. I think I understand that Salome Zurabishvili is still holding on, that the EU is still sending inane signals, but I think Georgia, they have already lost. I think Romania, they have unfortunately won, and they will win. They will continue winning. And I think one reason...
Yeah, but I mean what do you mean by winning? They get their way, but...
Yes, in that
the
sense.
Means in which they won is dubious at best.
Of course it's terrible, absolutely. What happened in Georgia is a coup. I mean, even Deutsche Welle, which you know is an extremely disinformation Western thing, even they admit that the evidence that the Constitutional Court in Romania used to annul the whole election was, in their words, flimsy, that the work of the secret services was shoddy and unprofessional. Even they admit that. And the worst thing about this is if I may say that, that they're already beginning to use it as a precedent. The current president of Romania, Karl Ioannis, I think, has been to that recent big EU had meeting in Brussels, and he basically told them, you know what, we were dealing with a very subtle sort of influence, which is code off, for we have no evidence at all, right? We're just fantasizing. And we stopped it, and you know what the next case is going to be? You told them, it's going to be Germany. You have to be very careful. So we are now in this world where they're making a claim that as soon as the intelligence services say something, you can basically forget about elections. And one last point, this is, of course, what people wanted to do to Trump in 2010 or 2016. Wait, I'm getting confused. 2010, right?
I think with all three elections, but anyway, yes.
Yeah, but this was the whole idea of the original Russia gate, the Russia rage scenario, right? Rachel Maddow goes on TV and says, the intelligence community, suddenly that was a thing, has decided this isn't a proper procedure, everything was wrong, and then we can topple a president. In America, unfortunately, it didn't work. But they're still on the same sort of trajectory. They're trying to train us into accepting that, that ultimately...
Well, let me throw it to George. One word we haven't mentioned in this part of the program is democracy, okay? And we see democracy subverted left in different ways, obviously. In Moldova, disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters in the diaspora, and it was called good, okay? Mm. Even though Moldovans in the West, the diaspora, were able to vote in multiple places, the diaspora in Russia were denied that, essentially. But Tariq is all right. I mean, on this menu here, there's a winner, at least as we're speaking now, and it's Georgia. Romania is probably the most problematic one because it's in the club. And now you have, you know, Brussels genuflecting to that. Tariq is absolutely right. Now the elections in Germany, well, you know, we can't prove it. You know, I just sense it. I just feel that there was something wrong. We have to cancel it, George.
Yes, that's exactly right. Because what happens is now in the West is that whenever election results don't go your way, and that's becoming the norm in many places, you say Russia. And then, of course, there's the next step is, okay, well, what's your evidence that Russia interfered, Russia affected the election outcome? Well, we don't have any evidence, but that doesn't mean that the Russia didn't interfere. And that was, in fact, stated by the Romanian president, Iohannis, said, yeah, well, we know the Russia interfered in the Romanian election, but it's very hard to find any evidence because the Russians are so cunning and so subtle and devious that we don't have the evidence. So it really does raise the interesting philosophical question, if a tree falls in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a noise? And that's the view within EU and NATO land, which is, well, just because there's no evidence of Russian interference, does that mean that there was no Russian interference? So, and now this is what the EU and NATO, and they have to concern themselves because you talked about the three countries that are on the regime change menu, but there are going to be more elections in 2025, elections in Bulgaria, elections in the Czech Republic, and therefore we know that the whole apparat is going to go into action because they can't guarantee these election victories anymore. They know perfectly well that they stole the election in Moldova, just as you said, that the people, the diaspora in Russia was unable to vote. And since even the final outcome was very close, then the question that had they been able to vote, then, you know, Maya Sandu would have lost. And this now is what how they're operating. Now, I agree with you. It does look like they have prevailed in Georgia. That in Georgia, obviously, they have quite a lot of experience already with regime change, and so they've managed so far to hold firm. But this really is how, you know, they operate in the EU, because ultimately they're the consensus that they represent, you know, well, the Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas and the rest. They just, there are no buyers within the EU. And so
it's very Soviet in its outlook, because, you know, actual existing socialism, you cannot reverse from it. It's a one-way direction, and they have the same kind of Bolshevik mentality about their belief system and how the apparat that is built to reinforce it. And also, Teddy, because I think it's really important to mention here, you know, the default position is that Russian interference, but in plain sight, it's EU interference left, right, and center. I mean, they're sitting in the cafes of these capital cities thwarting elections. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, they do very specific things. Like in the case of Georgia, for instance, they essentially threaten Georgian voters with a severe downgrading of their visa possibilities. So it was a very clear case of blackmailing the mass of the population, really, into a certain voting decision, right? The other thing is that I wanted to add is, I think you're absolutely right. There is something sort of like the Ursula von der Leyen Brezhnev doctrine, right? You can get into the camp, but you can't get out. But it's even worse, because you can't even discuss with them what the camp inside actually means. This is interesting because Georgian Dream and Georgescu in Romania, they both actually have stressed that they don't really want to break with the EU. That in reality, Georgescu was very explicit about this. What he wants is an equal relationship where he can preserve Romanian national interests. Now, Georgian Dream, very much the same statements, and they were believable. You can argue about what these governments and parties and leaders understand by national interest, but that's always the case. So what you have now from the EU is not only that you must stay here, it's redefine what is here, and there's only one way. It's the Ursula von der Leyen Kaya Kallas way.
You know, but and also lurking always in the background, George, for these countries that we're mentioning, Romania, Moldova, and Georgia, is what's going on in Ukraine. And that's unspoken, George.
It is unspoken. And of course, in the case of all three, they're very close to where the action is. So the most belligerent rhetoric is coming from those countries that are far away from the action. So the British government, it's the most bellicose, but then, you know, a long way from the action. You know, then you got, you know, governments in the Benelux. You know, they're also very bellicose. But when you get to Romania, and Romania, you know, is a arms hub, transferring weaponry into Ukraine. That's a very serious business, because if the war in Ukraine escalates and becomes a serious war between Russia and NATO, Romania is going to be in the front line of the action. Same goes for Hungary and Slovakia. So when you look at the map, it's the countries that are really very, very close and who know that if there's a war, we get clobbered badly. They're the ones who are saying, look, knock it off. This is a really bad idea. And therefore, they're the ones who have to get punished. And of course, Viktor Orban of Hungary, I mean, he's permanently in the crosshairs. They're all the time trying to promote opponents of his. But Romania is an interesting case, because the authorities there have a problem on their hands, because they said, we're going to hold new elections. But if they hold new elections, then Georgescu is going to win. I mean, like Trump, if you try to, you know, make sure he doesn't win, he's going to come back and he's going to be stronger than ever. And the Romanian authorities and the EU and NATO know this. And so what are they going to do? Well, the only thing they can do is ultimately just tell him, you can't run. You know, they just keep him off the ballot because, you know, otherwise they're back to where they started. So the EU and NATO have a lot of problems on their hands. And ultimately, as with Brezhnev, is all you can do is remove them from power and put them in prison because there's no other remedy.
You know, it's very interesting, gentlemen. I can remember after the Brexit vote in 2016 and all of these op-eds and editorials, one particularly stands out in mind, The Economist. We have too much democracy. There's too much democracy in the Western world. Yeah. And obviously, the meaning of that is that if you give people the last thing people have in the West, you've taken everything away from them. You've shuttered the middle class. One thing they have left is the franchise, and they're going to start, and they are taking away that away from them as well. The beacon of democracy is no longer the West. Maybe it never was. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Istanbul. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Rostov rules.